Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 23rd, 1999. We are in the fireside room of Koinonia this morning. Your presenter is Paul Palumbo. Today's session is 99-1. Paul begins his first Bible study at Holden with the title, Keep the Bloodline Straight. Let's listen in.
I guess. Well, welcome. We are going to be studying together for a week. I'm glad you came. The titles of this Bible study are a little obscure, I think. I did them a while back, and now that I see them up, I'm thinking, I bet you people don't understand a word of what that's about. But this week, I chose some stories that I thought would be interesting to look at, and to have us... that had something to do with family and the family tree that we are all a part of. And so today we're going to be taking a look at the story of Ruth and give you a little bit of quick background on what where Ruth fits in the whole scheme of things. And then we'll talk about some of the aspects of Ruth that I think are really interesting. So. If that's okay with everybody, that's how we'll proceed. And we'll begin with prayer. The Lord be with you. Let us pray. Gracious God, for this beautiful day, we give you thanks. We pray, O Lord, that as the day dawns, that your light will dawn upon us as we read your scripture. Guide us and enlighten us through this story of Ruth. Lead us, O Lord, to ever more abundant understanding of what you have in store for us through your marvelous grace. Amen. Okay, I think the first thing we ought to do is get the story of Ruth out there. So, does anybody know the story of Ruth that would like to tell it? You can just do the short version if you want. Nobody. Everybody's shy. Ruth was a lady. That's good. We've got all right. We've got one detail. Very important detail, by the way.
With two daughters-in-law.
Yes.
Actually, Ruth is one of the daughter-in-laws. Yeah, Naomi is the woman who has two daughters-in-law, right? Yeah, and this is a story you all know. I know it's just probably not the thing that you got up and read this morning, first thing. Well, I can do it.
The husband of Ruth dies, who's the son of Naomi, and which means they're both really kind of left. I mean, there's no one to help provide for them, and they were... Ruth was going to go back, she should have gone back to her family of origin, but decides instead to help her widowed orphaned mother-in-law to stay with her. And so then they're kind of stuck in a situation, how do they provide for themselves? And there is a distant relation named Boaz, who is rich with a farm, and Ruth goes to him and asks if they can at least glean the fields after the harvest has been gathered, which was provided, that was supposed to be done by observant religious people. And so they do that, and then Ruth goes, I'm a little fuzzy on this, but she goes even farther. She goes to Boaz, and there's sort of a pact made. I mean, she stays the night with him, and he indebts himself to Ruth, and therefore her mother-in-law. And so I'm kind of sketchy on that. That ultimately what happens is they get married, and there's now a place for both of them again.
Okay. Great. That's pretty good. Yeah. I bet you if you had a chance to read it once, boy, you'd get all the details. Yeah, that's great. We have, we have this story of essentially two women. This is... Now, Naomi has no luck at all. This poor woman is just She marries the guy. She goes to Moab with him, with their two sons. The two sons marry Moabite women, one of whom is Ruth, and Orpah's the other one. And, well, all of the men die. They just up and die. And, you know, I hate when that happens. So there they are. She's in a foreign land, and she decides she's going to go back to her people. And she says to her daughters-in-law, you go back to your people too. Go back to your people and you can start over and you're free. You can go marry somebody else now. You know, you have no indebtedness to us. And that's best because I'm a widow. I have nothing for you. And of course one does, Orpah does, but Ruth clings to Naomi. And there's that great famous line, where you go, I will go. Somebody do it. Do you know it by heart?
Treat me not to leave
you when I'm stuck. Whether thou goest, I shall goest, and where you lodge, I shall lodge, and your God shall be my God. And your people will be my people. There you go. That's a beautiful line from Ruth. It's one of the only places God is mentioned, too, by the way, that little line. And that's kind of an interesting piece of Ruth that we're going to take a look at. But so she goes with Naomi back to her people in Israel. And then they have this business with Boaz. Boaz is a distant relation to Naomi's husband. Okay? Ruth goes and gleans Boaz's field. Boaz takes a liking to Ruth. Then essentially Naomi does a little bit of behind the scenes manipulation, which is really going to be fun to look at. And before you know it, Boaz is figuring out how he's going to redeem Naomi and Ruth. And he does that, and they have a child. He does that and marries Ruth, and they have a child. And the child's name is Obed. And so that's, in a nutshell, the story. Except I'm leaving out a really important detail, which isn't fair. Obed has a son whose name is Jesse. And Jesse has a son whose name is David. Right. All right. Well, it's a really good story, right? What's the point of the story? Not much theology going on around there. More sex than theology, probably, in the story. So why did it survive in our canon? Why is it in our Bible?
Genealogy.
For genealogy. Yeah, really important piece, genealogy. Got to know where David comes from. I'm going to try to make the case today that that Ruth is a really subversive piece of literature on a number of levels. So if you're interested in subversion, Ruth is your book, I think. Let me back up just a little bit. I'm going to get a running start here historically and take a look at this chart back here real quick. In order to put Ruth in its proper place, let's go back all the way to the Judges. Now, remember, this is when the people of Israel, they'd wandered around for 40 years. They were basically a pain in the neck to Moses and to God. But they finally get into the land, and the land gets divided up. And there's sort of the northern half and the southern half. And they're kind of a confederation of these of the tribes. The 11 tribes and the two half-tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Basically, the book of Judges is the story of how God raises up judges, but they're not really judges like we know about judges. It's heroes, basically, and heroines who, when enemies come to threaten Israel or one of the tribes, they come together. A hero rises up and gets rid of the whoever, the Philistines or the Moabites or the Amorites or the Amalekites or any of those folks who were in that land who were threatening one of the tribes. So that's how the government worked. And then when there wasn't any threat, then there wasn't anybody who really was head over the tribes. Okay. The judge was brought out in a time of need. And that was God. That's the way God seemed to like it. But it certainly isn't the way that the people of Israel liked it. You'll remember, they looked around and they saw all the other nations and they all had what? Kings. And they said, we want to be like the nations. That's the great mantra. We want to be like the nations. And so there's that great exchange between the people and the prophet Samuel. And the people say, we want a king. And Samuel goes, no, you really don't want a king. And they say, yeah, we really want a king. No, you don't want a king. And then and they say, yes, we really want a king. And so Samuel goes to God, and God says, well, don't worry, Samuel. They haven't rejected you. They've rejected me. But give them what they want. But warn them first about what's going to happen. And so remember, this is, I'm going, only because I love this story, I'm going to tell it anyway. And so Samuel goes back to the people, and remember what he tells them? He says, okay, God says you can have a king, but this is what's going to happen. Your king is going to take your daughters, and he's going to take your sons to fight his battles, and he's going to take the best of your land, and he's going to take the best, the first of your fruits, and it's going to be miserable, and he's going to have your sons run in front of his chariots in times of war. They're going to be, didn't say cannon fodder, but that's what essentially what he means, and it's going to be not good. And they say, we want a king, and so a king. And of course, the first king is Saul. And this is the first time God ever had to pick a king, so he doesn't do a very good job in the first choice. Saul doesn't work out very well, and God says, I didn't do very well on that pick. Let me pick again. And so he rejects Saul, and he picks David. And of course, David is the king of Israel, of course. And what David does, his genius in part, is that he unites the northern and the southern kingdom, and he does that by putting the capital right in the middle, Jerusalem. Okay? So, and then everything is geared towards Jerusalem. And when you read through all of the history of the kings, it's kind of a fun thing. You'll go through, and most of the kings do not do what is good in the eyes of the Lord. And you wonder what that means. You know, they must have all done something different, but no, it ends up that they all do pretty much the same thing when they don't do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. That is, they don't emphasize worship exclusively in Jerusalem. And that's what's right in the eyes of the Lord. So when they do that, then they're labeled as having done what is good in the sight of the Lord. And if they don't do that, they are labeled with having not done what is good in the sight of the Lord. And that was free and has nothing to do with Ruth. Okay, so there's David, and then there's Solomon. And now you know Solomon and his splendor, and he builds the temple. And he also takes on all these foreign wives, which is a big problem, apparently, because the writers of his history sort of point to that as the downfall of his kingdom, bringing in all these foreign women with their foreign gods, and that's just not good, and it doesn't work out well. And what happens shortly thereafter, Solomon can't hold the kingdom together, and Jeroboam revolts in the north, and then before you know it, we have two kingdoms again. And so from there on, we have the history of two kingdoms, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom, which was called Israel, and the southern kingdom, which was called Judah. And the northern kingdom goes for a couple hundred years, and then in 722, the Assyrians come and just obliterate the Northern Kingdom. There's nothing left. And after that, there's really nothing, no history there. They're gone. And it's an astonishing thing for a people who believed themselves chosen of God that it's gone. And the people in the Southern Kingdom, they go on until 598 when the Babylonians come in and take them into exile. Now what that means is the Babylonians defeat the people of Judah, and in order to stop them from being, it's basic imperialism, you know how it works. If you want the people to not have leaders, you want the people not to have leaders, and not to have educated people, so they take the educated people and the artisans and the craftsmen and all the people who might possibly build up a resistance, and you take them and you put them in the empire, and where the empire is, which is in Babylon. And you try to make them Babylonians. See? And that way, you take them away, and then what's left is really sort of the poor folk, and they're not likely to organize against you. And the folks in Babylon are more likely to become Babylonians, because now they're living at the heart of the empire. Okay? So it's a dynamic that has worked over the centuries for many different empires. Well, some of the great stories that we have come from that time when, for example, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are in Babylon, and you know, they refuse to eat Babylonian food. They try to remain kosher, and they will not bow down to the Babylonian gods and all that stuff, all those great stories, and Daniel and stuff, all that is from this time. Now, in about 528 or so, the Cyrus of Persia defeats the Babylonians, and again, in good empirical style, now he wants to be in good with all the people that the Babylonians defeated. So he says, well, you all from Judah can go back to your land. And here, in fact, in Ezra, who's the priest who leads them back, Ezra says that the emperor gives them all kinds of money, and the people give them all kinds of gold and things, and send them back so that they can reestablish Jerusalem and their land. Right. Okay. Now, is that all fairly clear? So, Ezra and Nehemiah are the two places where we're going to find the stories of the exiles' return to Jerusalem, and they are commissioned to rebuild the temple and to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Well, those folks who went into exile, they had to figure out why this all happened. You know, I mean, why would God allow them to go into exile, right? I mean, wouldn't you want to know why it happened? Especially if you're going to go to reestablish the land, you'd want to know what to avoid, wouldn't you? So they're thinking, well, why did God do this? And it would be, you know, we could be sitting around and we could probably come up with some theories of our own. Well, what Ezra comes up with, and it's probably the dominating ideal in this whole business, is, well, when Moses led us all the way up to the promised land, and Joshua took us in, we were told that we were supposed to drive out all of the foreign peoples out of the land, and that we were not supposed to mix with them. Now remember Solomon? Solomon mixed with those other people, and that was the beginning of the end. So our task when we go back is to make sure that we don't mix with anybody else. We got to keep our bloodlines pure. That way, we will be pure before God. And we won't offend our God. Makes perfect sense. Well, Ezra, we should take a look in at Ezra. Articulates this pretty well. In chapter 9 of Ezra, which is after Chronicles, I think there's Esther in between Chronicles and Ezra. Yeah, okay. In the 9th chapter of Ezra, we get a taste of this whole business. After these things had been done, the officials approached me, that's Ezra, and said, "The people of Israel, the priests and the Levites, have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with their abominations, from the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. For they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons. Thus, the holy seed has mixed itself with the peoples of the lands. And in this faithlessness, the officials and leaders have led the way." Well, when I heard this, I tore my garment and my mantle and pulled hair from my head and beard and sat appalled. Then all who trembled at the words of the God of Israel because of the faithlessness of the returned exiles gathered around me while I sat appalled until the evening sacrifice. Right? The holy seed. This is a really powerful word, powerful phrase. Gets mixed with foreigners. All those other ites out there. And all those ites, the Jebusites and the Moabites, they're all the folk who were supposed to be driven out of the land in the first place. At least according to the stories from Moses. But they weren't. And so Ezra's faced with a problem. And the problem is, what am I going to do with these people we've returned, and now all of a sudden they're taking foreign wives again? And so Ezra's response to the problem is to say, get rid of your wives and your kids. Send them away. And they do. They send away all their foreign wives, they send away the kids from their foreign wives, so that we will have the purity that we are supposed to have before God in this place. And not only do they send away those foreign wives, but the people who remained on the land, remember during the exile, they shipped away the educated and the artisans and all those folks. The people who stayed on the land, when the exiles returned, the people who stayed on the land were not allowed to participate in the rebuilding of the temple or the walls of Jerusalem. Because it was feared that they had intermingled and intermarried with people who had come in, with the Babylonians and all those other folks who had been around. Okay, so it wasn't just the Amorites, but it was also their fellow Jews who had also been who had not been deported. They weren't allowed to participate either. So it's in that, yes?
How long were they in Babylon?
They were in Babylon for about, let's see my math, 598 to 528. Oh, what's that?
70 years.
70 years?
70 years.
70 years. Yeah. And it, so it's, you know, several generations. Then the so that's this is the atmosphere that we're narrowing in on the story of Ruth now. Okay, this is the atmosphere that's going on. Do you have?
Yeah. did the men basically just say to their foreign-born wives, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you? I mean, is that how that was done?
Yeah, and sent them back to their parents' families.
Okay, so that they, it was all legit in terms of the law, how they did that. You could just summarily divorce a woman, and even if she was foreign-born, all the obligations of marriage could be just terminated at the discretion of the husband.
Right. They wouldn't have needed anything extra than what they already had to dismiss them. Mm-hmm. Because even marriages that were not from marrying a foreign woman, you still, there was not a whole lot there was not a whole lot of formality needed for a divorce anyway. So this would have been even easier, because this is what the prophet said you had to do, this is what you did.
They had to pay, if there was a marriage contract, they would have to pay the family of the wife
right.
a price
right.
if they divorced them for any reason other than adultery, I think. Mm-hmm. Usually was the way the contracts were written.
Right.
So there's probably quite an impoverishment of Israel when they did that, because to pay the price, you had to, I mean, that was not an easy thing probably in many cases to do.
Yeah, that could well be.
Economically, there may have been quite a bit of impoverishment for people.
Right.
And
yeah,
then,
I
then
think
they couldn't
could
get
well
employment
be.
Building the temple, so it was kind of a double whammy.
Yeah, that's right. Because if they didn't send them away, they were yeah. Well, yeah, and it isn't really clear. I don't think that the economic aspect of that is emphasized very much. It's pretty much summarily they just send them off.
So it sounds like you had this class of people who are kind of, when they returned, they were the new folks on the block, and they basically started calling the shots. Mm-hmm. And imposed their will on everyone else in a way that probably caused a lot of hardship to all those who are still there.
Absolutely. And the book of Ezra is really filled with some of the political battlings between the people who were already there and the people who come. The people who are already there, when the people come in and start acting as if they're in charge, well, they fire off a letter to the emperor, to the governor. And it's really kind of fun, because in Ezra it says they fire it off and they write it in one language and it has to be translated. And when it was translated, then the governor read it, and then he wrote a letter and it was translated back, and it came back to... And for a while they were able to stop them from building the temple. And then more letters were sent off, and finally it was deemed that Cyrus had indeed sent them to build the temple, and so then it was the last word, and so then they went on. But so there was a lot of intrigue between those two groups, and it's all in Ezra, and it's kind of fun to read if you have a few minutes to read it. It's not very long. So the business of sending away the women and the kids too allows them to have what they understand to be the purity that they need to continue. So they do, and they're building the temple. That becomes the sort of national myth, if you will, that we are now going to have the purity that we need to continue. And now what happened before won't happen to us now. Fine. Well and good.
Sounds dangerously familiar.
Though. Sounds dangerously familiar. It sure does. Yeah. What do you have in mind?
Well, Germany. And then wondering how this plays in modern Israel,
uh-huh.
which has a lot of outsiders, as far as they're concerned, living in it.
And in the last hour, ethnic cleansing was the word that that was batted about a bit. Yeah. Yeah, it does sound kind of familiar. Ruth is a great subversion of this, and we're going to explore that. That whole national mythology, Ruth sort of, with very understated way, and using some very unlikely characters, a couple of women, subverts that whole national mythology. Now, how does that happen? Well, in a nutshell, it happens like this. It all happens at the end of the story. Ruth, a Moabite, one of the Ites that Ezra doesn't like so much, has a son named Obed, who has a son named Jesse, who has a son named David. Who is King David? The story of Ruth says, if David were to be submitted to the same strict regulations that you are putting on people now, David would not have been able to participate in the rebuilding of the temple. David would not be a pure Jew in the sense that you all want people to be. Isn't that an interesting thing? King David himself, you've excluded. How absurd is that? It's a great testament, I think, to the story of Ruth that it survived. You know, because it went against the grain so much. But I think the reason that it survived was its subtlety. And I think we ought to look at it some. We have Well, first of all, let me just stop right there. And is there any comment or question or confusion, anything? Yes?
Didn't people believe in those days that it was really only the male that was, I mean, the male had, the male seed was all the contribution to the life of the future being that was created, that the woman was merely this passive vessel in which the seed grew. So where was the mixing? Because they didn't have a sense of, you know, man has half the genes and woman has half the genes. So I was just wondering why they felt that it mattered at all, mm-hmm. whether a woman was Jewish or not. Mm-hmm. Because if the man was Jewish, then if the man's seed was pure, it didn't matter in which vessel it grew up.
I'm not so sure that is the case, only because if you think about all of the legislation that Moses puts down before they go into the land, that they're not to take, they're not to go after the gods, and they're not to go after the temple prostitutes, and they're not to mix their seed with other people. Really, that was the only way they could have mixed their seed with other people, is with the women of other nations. So, although they may have thought of the woman as a passive vessel in some sense, there's still the sense that that's the way you mix the blood, and it ought not to happen. So, yeah, and I'm not exactly sure that, I mean, it may be both are true, and they're just kind of, you just have to live with both. But,
Well, it must have been obvious that the children had characteristics of both parents, so they knew there would have to be someone.
Yeah, yeah.
I should think that they probably weren't, they obviously weren't thinking genetically, but I think they were thinking influentially mixing, or...
Yeah.
Yeah, influence is mixing.
Yep. Yeah, clearly. That as well. And that's most clear in Joshua, where they're trying to make sure that you don't go after those the other religions, because those other religions, you see, they were really tempting when they went into the land. They needed to figure out how to stop being a nomadic people and how to be a people who could farm. Well, the people who knew how to farm were already there. And they knew perfectly well how to farm. They had a fertility cult, and they had temple prostitutes, and that's how you got the farm to go. And so you went in and you had sex with the temple prostitutes, and your farm works. It's all figured out. There's this whole mythology about how this works. And for a group of nomads who just come into the land, that's, you know, for the men, that's pretty, that looks like a pretty tempting thing, huh? Wait, let me get this straight now. I have sex, and that's my religious obligation. I like that. So the influence of that is really strong. And they want to survive, and they want to learn how to cultivate the land. Well, you go to the experts, and the experts simply had this mythology, which was antithetical to what the God of the wilderness expected for God's people. So it is very much influential and theological and all of that stuff. So so you don't want to be intermingling in that sense.
I heard that in today's world, you're really not considered, or maybe not today's world, at some point along the line, you really aren't considered Jewish unless your mother is Jewish, because
right.
During the nomadic times, you don't know who the father might have been.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It kind of does flip-flop. And you get that sense from the Gospels in Matthew and Luke. You get one genealogy from the father's side, and you get one genealogy from the mother's side. And it's very interesting. So it's not always clear-cut as to which side you're tracing it from. You're right.
And that purity issue does carry through in today's world in terms of intermarriage and rabbinical blessings on mixed marriages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are still questions and issues involved in all of those things. Right. Yeah. Yep, exactly. Uh-huh. Other comments?
You mentioned about even David, because excluded.
Yes.
I'm thinking about Joseph. How many of Joseph came to area after the Samaritan king? You see, these are sort of the conflict between pure Judean families.
Mm-hmm.
Among them, Joseph family. Joseph married with Egyptians.
Yes.
So is there any stereotype thinking between Judaism and the Samaritan?
Right.
So not only started from the David period, but also from
further
the
back.
First beginning.
Yeah.
Of Exodus.
Yes.
Before entering Canaan.
Right.
Already.
That's right. That's right. This story could very well have been told about Joseph as well as David. Right. Yep. Other comments? That's great. Okay. So, well, let's look at Ruth a little bit in more detail. I think that it's also, that's sort of the political piece of it, but I also think there's a gender piece in it that's absolutely delightful. And we should look at. So here we go. Okay, now, poor Naomi. She marries this guy, and they go off to this land. And like I said, she has no luck at all. They go back, and remember that widows and orphans have no real standing. There's just nothing there for them, other than the whatever justice people want to offer them. Okay, and that means that there is a law by which the next of kin if the husband dies, the husband's next of kin has the right, obligation, all of those things, to redeem Naomi and Ruth. Okay? But that often is simply ignored. And the widow is left without anything. Because the widow can't have property. Because in the sense that you were talking about, in that sense, they're not considered a person who could own wealth. So they're dependent on the charity of others. Okay? And that's just the way it was. And the prophets wail on Israel because they aren't taking care of the widows and the orphans. You know? And say, this is how the nations will be judged, by how well they take care of the poor, the widows and the orphaned. It's not by the size of your army. It's not by how much wealth you accumulate. It is plain and simple, how well did you take care of the poor among you? That is, in a nutshell, the word of the prophets on this matter. However, and that word simply shows you the reality. The reality is that the widows and the orphans are not being taken care of. So there's Naomi, and she's got nothing. And Ruth, and she's got nothing. And they go, and they have to do this gleaning, as we were told. And that's how they gather up their food, and that's how they get their grain. And Ruth goes. She has this idea that if she goes to the threshing floor, and I think Ruth has got, she's got a lot of self-confidence, is what I think. She says to Naomi, let me go to the threshing floor. Perhaps someone will take a liking to me. And off she goes. And she happens onto Boaz's land there, and Boaz notices her and talks to her and sends her home. And actually he says, yeah, you're pretty famous around here because of your faithfulness to Naomi. So, yeah, very good. Good for you. Sends her back to Naomi. Naomi says, well, go back again tomorrow and see what happens of this. And then, so Ruth goes back a second time. And this time, now, Boaz is telling his workers, now, y'all, leave a lot for Ruth. In fact, take some of your bundles and drop them so she can pick them up. It's great. And don't bother her. Just leave them. And so Ruth comes back, and she's got more than she could carry, right? And she takes it back. She takes it back to Naomi. Now Naomi is no fool. She sees what's going on here. She says, okay, all right. So she says, here's what you must do. Boaz has the right of redemption to us. Okay? Boaz is related to my husband. All right? So he has the right to redeem us. All right? He can do that. And so here's what you do. You go, and when Boaz has finished his work, and he's finished eating, and he's finished drinking, and is reclining, you go and lay at Boaz's feet. And Ruth says, okay. And the rabbis say that this is not what it sounds like. Feet is a euphemism here. Ruth is going to be as seductive as she can be. and she's going to lay with Boaz. She goes, and after he's finished drinking, she climbs in under the covers and lays next to Boaz. And it's great. Boaz wakes up at midnight. Where is that? It's kind of funny.
Chapter 3.
Oh, yeah, here it is. Okay, then she came stealthily. Now, see, that's a word, you know, stealth bombers and all that. You know, that's a new... and uncovered his feet and lay down. Well, again, remember, that's a euphemism. Uncovered his body and covered his... And at midnight, the man was startled and turned over. And there lying at his feet was a woman. Wow! Look at that! Okay, and then he goes on to say, well, you know, this is great, but I don't have the first right of redemption over Naomi and you. There's another fellow who does. Someone who's closer to your father-in-law. And I'll go ask him if he wants to do this. But you stay here tonight. That's kind of an interesting thing too, right? He doesn't say leave now. He says stay here the night. But he does say get up before anybody could see you and leave. All right. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Boaz is an honorable man. Okay. And so, and the next day, he gathers up. He goes to the man. Actually, Ruth goes home to Naomi. Reports to Naomi. Says, "This is what happened." Naomi says, "All right. Well, just stay here. He'll take care of it by the end of the day today." And she's right. Immediately, Boaz goes to the fellow who has the right of redemption, and he says, "You know that all of Naomi's husband's stuff is available to be bought and to be redeemed." And the guy says, "Well, shucks, I'll take that." And Boaz says, "Well, yeah, but if you do that, you get Ruth as well as a wife." And apparently, this fella had some other arrangements, and if he took another wife, he would lose his other inheritance. So he says, "Well, I can't do that, because then I'd lose my other inheritance." And Boaz says, "Well, if I must, I will." And so he goes and redeems Naomi and Ruth, and marries Ruth. And then they get married, they have a child, and then, as you know, they have Obed and Jesse and David. I find this really interesting that these two women, and Naomi especially, I love Naomi. She just sits back and watches what happens, and then she goes, "Just sit down here, sweetheart. Everything's going to be fine. We're going to take care of this." At least that's the image I get. What image do you get of her?
Good chicken soup making Jewish mom.
Yeah. Isn't she, though? Isn't she? Yeah. She sees what's happening, and she is willing to
stir the soup.
Thank you. Who said that? Yeah, stir the soup. Right. Yeah, exactly. Anything else about these two? What do you think about Ruth?
She does have self-confidence.
Yeah. Doesn't she? Yeah, she's bold. I think she's really bold. Yeah, she goes right up to Boaz and whoop, slips right in.
She's also obedient.
She's also obedient. She's already at the beginning, and that's what she's famous for already. She's gonna do whatever Naomi tells her to do. She's got that much faith in Naomi, right? And then there she goes. And so she trusts what Naomi says and the guidance that she gives, and does what she's told by Naomi. Yeah.
Paul, what do you mean by redemption exactly? Maybe you explained this earlier, but what do you mean he has the power to redeem? Is the power to set us free, or what?
To
claim.
Two things.
Yeah.
The property of her husband can be redeemed, that is to be claimed as their own.
Okay.
Also, to marry and to have children so that the dead still have a connect, so that the dead spouse has a connection to the land of the living through the offspring.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
So that the widow doesn't even get to keep her belongings or her husband's belongings.
Naomi can't own the property, so she can't keep that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so it's kind of a Levitical law, I mean, as far as...
Yeah, anything. Right, exactly.
So if she didn't marry, what would happen to that land?
It would go back to the husband's family, eventually. Yeah.
Does the term redemption apply to the people or to the property? Is the property
both
redeemed? Or, okay, so it's both.
Right. Well, actually, the distinction is very blurry there between the person and the property. Mm-hmm. It's property.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that the sense in which, this is a digression, but is that the sense in which Jesus as Redeemer is understood by the people of that time, that we're all sort of orphans?
Oh, that's delicious, yeah.
I don't know, I just wonder.
Sure. I think that's a delicious understanding of the way Jesus is doing. Sure. We have a very spiritualized sense of redeeming, but us as orphans, and Jesus redeems us and gives us a home. I think that's, yeah.
And that's up in his genealogy even.
I'm sorry?
It's up in his genealogy even.
Yeah, he's got a long history. That's right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, like great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother? Like son, or something like that, yeah. So, yeah, that.
It's kind of sad that they put so much more emphasis and importance on the offspring than on the woman and the widow. And what, you know, and we have to ask ourselves today, what emphasis do we place on our young more than our old? And I guess as you read that, and someone who works in a care facility, that kind of hit me as you read that we put so much more emphasis on our young people and their worth and dreams and mm-hmm. goals to be sure they're okay. But what do we say to our more mature women and men? And even what about our single people? Where do the single people fit into all of this too?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Since you're throwing out ideas.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
First, children were the social security of that era. They were to take mm-hmm. care of their parents.
Right. There is that too. There is the Levitical law, however, is really very much for the sake of the dead. That their name continue on. And that they not be... the Hebrew Bible and its understanding of death is very, very different than what we've evolved it into. But... So one of the things that there hasn't been a lot, the rabbis have not developed a whole big thing about what happens after death. I mean, when you talk to rabbis, they'll say, well, you know, why are you guys asking me that? Y'all have done far more work on that than we have, you know, talking to Christians. But you die, you go to Sheol, all right? That's not... it's not hell. It's just a place, and you're not really dead, and you're not really alive. Yeah, you can't even talk about it like that. You're kind of have this little. You have an existence that's not really an existence. It's very vague, at best. But the idea is then. But if you have offspring, if you have kids. Then you're somehow still connected to the living, and therefore to the living God. So it's very important. That's the emphasis is, and that's what some of this redemption is about. That the dead still have a connection to the living God. and that's through the living, their kids. So when a brother that and even in the time of Jesus, when they're talking about they're trying to trap him, and they say a guy has a wife and he dies, and then his brother marries her and he dies, and then the brother marries the next brother, whose wife will she be? Well, the reason all the brothers are marrying her is because that's their obligation to marry her and have children for the sake of the dead brother. Okay? And then Jesus then dismisses all of his nonsense but that's the idea. Okay? So that's why it is so important to have the offspring.
It seems like it's also, again, there's an economic thing here. I mean, I don't want to undermine the idea of the dead living on and their offspring, but it seems like there's really a strong weight to children, because that's where the property goes. I mean, you know, and I know that Jesus was not wanting to put the emphasis on that. That was something he challenged. But that here, even, you know, the offspring being there to keep the property going, and then somehow the dead live on through their things that just keep going and accumulating.
Yeah, and there's a temptation, and I fall to that temptation often, to say, oh, no. But think about being a nomadic people. Think about not having a place. And then all of a sudden you have a place. And I think that's just a whole different mentality than what we have. And that's why place is so important. And that's why you got to have to go through all of these lists before you go into the land of, all right, from this tribe and this clan and this family, there's this many people. And from this clan, da-da-da, and they're listed on and on, ad nauseum, okay? Because each one of those persons gets a stake in this land, and that anchors them. Okay, and it's and that's, I think, to be respected in some ways. I mean, obviously, it can go to extremes, but at least on the surface, we have to understand how important that is.
Well, it's in contrast to what you're saying about the Northern Kingdom. Being just, it vanishes.
Yeah.
I mean, that was known to people, what it's like to just be a vanished mm-hmm. people.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to what you were saying earlier about this being a subversive kind of text. And I'm looking at the chapter 4. And it's presumed that Naomi's older. She's already born two adult male children who have each had wives for 10 years, and so there's some advancement of years here. Because mm-hmm. By rights, Boaz should have married Naomi. But instead, Ruth goes in her stead.
Right.
And there's this sort of linkage, and it's even explicit here, of Rachel and Leah, of the sort of less physically desirable woman who is dealt with first, and then the more attractive woman is dealt with. But here, the reversal of that. It's Ruth who's dealt with, but it's really on behalf of Naomi, and it's really her only reason for being attractive, property-wise, not physically-wise, but property-wise, is because of her affiliation, how she's tethered herself to Naomi, uh-huh. which then lets Boaz have both Elimelech, as well as Chilion and Malon's property.
Right.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's really subversive in the sense that it allows for an affiliation that's not blood-related to be taken seriously in the midst of all the Levitical understandings of redemption through offspring and bloodlines.
Very so nice.
That's what I thought you were going with, the subversive.
Right.
That it's giving this credence to an element of affiliation as being acceptable, despite all the other laws to, that was, in a sense, especially with the Ezra understanding, to push all that off to the side.
Right, absolutely. I think that's really good. And Naomi sort of sets that up. Well, the story writer, but Naomi, out of Naomi's mouth, is set up right at the beginning when she's trying to get the two daughters-in-law to go back to their family. She says, "What, you think I'm going to bear children and you're going to wait around for them? This isn't going to happen. I'm done with that. I'm not going to bear, even if I got married today, or you were going to, and even if by miracle I could have a child, you're not going to wait to marry them, right?" So she's kind of beyond that, the possibility. And so that business of affiliation is absolutely right. I think that's great. Yeah. I hadn't connected it quite that way, but I think that's really good. Yeah. Are there other comments or questions or concerns? I think that the women in the story are they express a woman in my congregation, when I told her this story, said she looked at me and she said, "Wily women." And I thought, well, that's a pretty good description of these two, Naomi and Ruth both. Yeah.
My reaction is, they are to some extent, but my first reaction is that they're desperate. These are women in such straits. They will go to extreme lengths to get themselves out of this dire predicament that they're in. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's, I feel great, I can just sense their anxiety and anguish at being totally bereft of any connection, any safety net. Mm-hmm. These are basically homeless people. In a whole new community, trying to find a niche, mm-hmm. and they probably don't have a lot of time because, you know, they're hungry and they're probably penniless. Mm-hmm. And so that's yes, they're you know, wily and strategic about how they're going about it. But I think what's motivating it all is desperation.
Yeah.
But don't you think there were a lot of other women maybe in their same predicaments that would have gone to such length, and maybe a lot of them did what they had to do to survive. Mm-hmm. So maybe on the other hand of it, this story is more common than we think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
On the other side of that, you know, sometimes you do what you have to do.
Mm-hmm. In fact, this is probably, it's probably deliberate, mm-hmm. that this is the way the social system has been set up. I mean, women were at a certain social class, and if they lost their husbands, they were immediately dropped to the lowest social class, the totally bereft. And in this way, they became prime candidates for exploitation, mm-hmm. by some other man who needed some cheap labor.
And that's why Boaz says, "Hey, leave this one alone."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, because
he knew what would happen to a woman in her situation.
So this is a society that probably had no shortage of female servants. Very loyal female servants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Desperation, I think, is definitely a part of what happens in this story. Yeah, there's no question.
When you talked about place, it made me think of homelessness. And, you know, I think that's a good analogy, mm-hmm. for us to imagine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that for us? Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. If you're gonna want to come back tomorrow, you might want to read the story of Jonah.